Now back to Cleveland Browns Daily with Jim Donovan and Matt Wilhelm on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Welcome back, everybody. Cleveland Browns Daily on this June 27th. We are coming up to the 4th of July. Al Gross was the other safety. That's right.
Found the picture.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Jim Donovan in for Nathan Zagura. Matt Wilhelm is here. The reason we're talking about in the mid-80s, that great secondary for the Cleveland Browns, is because today, on this June 27th, 30 years ago, I remember being in the Channel 3 newsroom at the time when we got this call from Sacramento, California, that Don Rogers, the outstanding safety for the Browns, who was right on the doorstep of being a great safety for many, many years out of UCLA, had been rushed to the hospital with an overdose, and he died on the night before he was to get married. We have a very, very talented writer. Jerry Bembry joins us, senior writer at ESPN's TheUndefeated.com, and he wrote an article going back. Jerry, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hey, Jim and Matt, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jerry, I have to tell you, that was a shocking night. It was the night before, as I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was the night before he was to be married, and it was after his bachelor's party, right?
It occurred right after his bachelor's party, which happened on a Thursday night. Don went to his mother's home in Sacramento, the house he purchased for her, on Friday, early Friday morning, went to sleep, woke up, and called out to his mom that he needed some assistance, and he basically collapsed in the house. He was rushed to the hospital and pronounced dead that afternoon. And it just a shocking story, especially coming 8 days after Len Bias died of a cocaine overdose in College Park, Maryland. So it's just really two big shocking stories about these two great athletes who died in a short span of each other of a cocaine overdose.
I did not remember that it was so close to the time that Len Bias had died. Jerry, let me just tell you this story about that part of the connection. The Cavaliers had the top pick in that draft that year, and I was at the draft. It was at the old Boncourt Hotel in downtown Cleveland, and everybody was booing when the Cavaliers selected Brad Daugherty because they wanted the Cavs to select Len Bias. And then the next day, the story comes out that Bias had died and had dropped dead. And the Celtics ended up with nothing, of course, at a time when a lot of people thought that if the Celtics had gotten Len Bias and he had continued to play the way he did at Maryland with Bird and McHale and all those Parrish, they would have won a ton of championships. Jerry, I have to tell you this, that the Browns at that time, Don Rogers was just about ready to become one of those very, very famous safeties, those hard-hitting, knock-em-down safeties in the NFL. His career, his greatness was truly in front of him.
It was. He was the defensive rookie of the year. He had a really special career at UCLA. And, you know, his teammates in Cleveland, from the accounts that I read, they spoke glowingly about
about
how much of an athlete. You know, I spoke to a reporter who covered the high school scene in Sacramento. And if you read the story, The Undefeated, he mentions that, you know, Don was a great basketball player. Don was a great football player. He ran track and was one of the most talented guys. He said that one of his coworkers said that you need to see this guy play baseball. He's unbelievable in that sport as well. And he could have been a decathlon champion, a world-class champion, based on his athletic talent. He was just that good in everything that he did. So it was just really a sad story. And, you know, I'm that would have been a devastating loss for Cleveland had they drafted Len Bias and had these back-to-back against each other.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, that would have been something else. I didn't even know that they were seriously considering taking Len Bias.
I will never forget it, how the Cavaliers got booed for selecting Brad Daugherty because people were chanting as the clock ticked down, you know, before they made the pick. They wanted Len Bias. And, I mean, imagine that. And then on the heels of that, you lose a guy that really – was just an incredible athlete, Matt.
It's again. What are you going to do? And I think in today's day and age, and that's where I was going with my question is, you just look. And I was reading a Pro Football Talk article about the number of players that are in professional sports and getting in trouble or having these types of situations are actually down, but the numbers are actually up with former players dealing with their own law enforcement type of, you know, off the field issues now.
Yeah, you know, I think that Don Rogers and Len Bias was a wake up call to a lot of different athletes. Last week, I wrote a story about Len Bias' death through the eyes of Keith Gatlin, who was a teammate.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of people tweet me and said, you know what? Len Bias is the reason why I never used drugs in my life.
Hmm.
To see someone this special drop dead was the reason why I never used drugs. And I think people see the same way about Don. I think it's a shame because every year it's a big remembrance about Len Bias, but no one ever really speaks about Don Rogers. And I think it's sad because he was, again, equally as talented, and it should be a message that should be taught to young students, young student athletes around the country.
So, Jerry, this ripped apart his family, didn't it? His brother was a great player, played at the University of Washington, went into the NFL. He struggled with it. Your story really kind of goes through the eyes of his son, right?
Absolutely. You know, and his son looks just like him. If you sit, and I sat across the table from him in Sacramento, and I'm looking at this guy, and he looks just like his dad. And, you know, again, you mentioned Reggie was a great athlete, who's an NFL first-round pick with the Detroit Lions, and wound up being in a car accident where he T-boned three teenagers and killed them in Pontiac, Michigan, had a whole series of alcohol and drug problems throughout his life, and he eventually died in 2013 of an alcohol and cocaine intoxication. His sister, Jackie, was one of the most talented players in the history of Northern California in basketball. And she had a scholarship offer to Oregon State. But after Don died, you know, she went through a listless senior year in high school, went to Oregon State for a year and dropped out. And she had some substance abuse problems throughout her life. And the mom, the day after Don died, she suffered a heart attack. She was in the hospital the day of the funeral. And she wound up dying of a heart attack in the year 2000. So here you have this young man, Don Rogers Jr., whose life could have been different if his dad was still alive. His dad was still an NFL player. You know, he'd have had all the privileges associated with that.
Right.
And now he's had this tremendous struggle throughout his life, tremendous tragedy throughout his life. And it's almost a really, really sad story with him.
Jerry, because the story really touched me because I will never forget the night when that story came in. Just to tell you how we got the story in our newsroom in Cleveland about Don Rogers. It was a Friday night when the call came in, and there was a sportscaster who used to work at the station that I worked at, and he had moved to Sacramento. Now, this is before the HIPAA laws, okay? So the next part of the story, you know, it gets interesting. His wife was a nurse at the hospital that Rogers was brought into, obviously in cardiac arrest from the overdose, and he called us up and said, Don Rogers just came to my wife's hospital, and it looks like it's a drug overdose. And we called up the Browns, and it was Kevin Byrne, who was the media relations person at the time, who is now in Baltimore when the team left and moved and became the Ravens. And I remember calling him up and saying, hey, Kevin, can you tell me where Don Rogers is? And he said, yeah, he's getting married tomorrow. He's out in Sacramento. And I said, I think you better check that out because there's a bad story going around. It was shocking.
Yeah, there were a couple of teammates in Sacramento at the time of the wedding. Hamper Dixon was there.
Right.
You know, I know Paul Warfield had just spoken to Don that morning before he collapsed. And when they had the funeral the next week, and it was at the old Arco Arena, members of the Browns were there. Members of the UCLA football family were there. Jesse Jackson spoke at the service. And if go back and read the story, this young man, Don Rogers Jr., was 4 years old at the time his dad died. And he tells me the story about getting dressed that morning of the funeral. And, you know, everybody's got tuxedo and black suits on. Not tuxedos, but black suits on. And getting in limousine and walking into Arco Arena. And that was the first moment he knew his dad was dead. He saw his dad in a casket.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was the moment he saw and he knew that his father was dead. And how sad is that for a kid? That's got to be traumatic for him.
Jerry, how did his fiance, who was, you know, on the verge of becoming his wife, how did she live through this?
His fiance actually went on to Harvard Business School, and she has since remarried. I tried to reach out to her and was unable to reach her, but you know, I read some accounts with her, and she was devastated as well in the story. You know, she's quoted from an old newspaper story where she says, if Don had only made it to Saturday, and that was the wedding
right.
day.
That's right.
If he only made it to Saturday,
yeah.
everything would have been okay. And, I mean, that's something that everybody has to live with. I mean, I just can't imagine being the day before you're just standing at the altar getting married and that your spouse, the person you're going to marry, just drops dead. It's just such a sad story on so many different levels.
It is. And what is Don Rogers Jr., where is he living? What is he doing nowadays?
He lives in Sacramento right now. He works as an auditor with Marriott, but he's had a troubled life. You know, he's gone through situations where he lost jobs. You know, he didn't have any financial support. His grandmother was his big financial backer and supporter. And when she died in 2000, it just kind of really crippled the rest of the family. And so he's had some struggles along the way. But, you know, he's trying his best to maintain. You know, substance abuse, sometimes it goes from generation to generation. He hasn't had any of those issues at all. So that's a blessing. That he hasn't had to deal with that, but he had to see his whole family pretty much collapse around him.
He was part of, Jerry, he was part of the inception of what is now so affectionately known as the Dog Pound. It was that defense, but specifically that secondary of Dixon and Minifield, Al Gross and Donnie Rogers in the back of that. Those four guys, and I was pointing out to Matt Wilhelm here, who sits alongside me here this afternoon, that there was a great poster that came out. They were great in building themselves up to really market themselves, and Donnie was a part of that. And there's a great shot of the four of them, and they all had like these big guard dogs.
Yeah,
you know, they
the
were
white
all
tuxedos,
yeah,
the
white
black cummerbund.
Yeah, oh man. He was a great, as you point out in your article, and I would urge everyone to go read it at ESPN.com, theundefeated.com. It's a fascinating story about a guy that probably was going to be one of the greats at his position in the NFL, as you in the read of your article, you point out so well. This guy could do anything athletically, and he was going to be great at it.
And that was an era where the Browns were a good team. They were
yes.
they had, you know, a winning squad. And you know, after his death, the next couple of years, they were still, you know, well above 500. They were 10-5 the year after he died, and 10-6 the year after that. I mean, he could have been a difference maker. And there were some of his teammates who said at the time that if we had Don Rogers, that could have made a big difference for us on our defense. And, you know, the Believe Lane documentary came out recently on ESPN 30 for 30, and Don Jr. said he was at work one day, and the TV happened to be on ESPN. He looked at the screen, and he sees his dad. You know, he didn't even know that he was part of that documentary project.
Right.
He just saw an image of him walking off a bus, I believe. It just kind of really kind of shocked him a little bit. But he's reminded about his father every step of the way. He gets stopped at grocery stores and barbershops because his resemblance is so much alike like his father. And it's a constant reminder about, you know, the life that his dad lived. And he Googles his dad because he doesn't know a lot. Doesn't have a lot of memories mm-hmm. about his father, just one-on-one.
Jerry, thanks so much for joining us. It's a terrific article, and I would urge everyone to get to ESPN.com and read it, theundefeated.com. And the story, 30 years ago, Don Rogers, the incredibly talented young safety of the Cleveland Browns, passed away on the eve of his wedding. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Jim and Matt, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It really is. You should go and read the story. It's
yeah.
an amazing story. I mean, that was at a time where the Cincinnati Bengals had a huge safety. I think his name, David Fulcher was his name. And of course you had, and this is in the heyday, Ronnie Lott of the 49ers and Gary Fensick of the Bears. And he had all these big safeties.
And you finally felt like we got our guy.
And we got our guy. This guy was amazing. I mean, and his great years were just about ready to come. A really sad story. Shocking time in Cleveland. And I give the Browns a lot of credit for being able to pull it together. Marty pulled it together that year, and they had a very, very good team the next year and a great defense. But, think about it. June 27th, they're not far away from going to training camp.
You're right.
Right? So he was going to get married, come to town, and get ready
maybe
for training
maybe
camp.
Maybe hit a honeymoon,
yeah,
you know, very quickly, and then
right.
ramp it back up like we talked about at the opening of the show.
Yeah. We'll take a break, and we will be back with more. We've been asking you about your top three sports moments in Cleveland, and we'd love you to call in, 216-578-0850. Jim Donovan, Matt Wilhelm. We are counting down to July 29th when the Browns open it up here in Berea for training camp, and we'll be back with more on Cleveland Browns Daily right after this.
Now back to Cleveland Browns Daily with Jim Donovan and Matt Wilhelm on ESPN 850 WKNR.
And we're back. Jim Donovan, Matt Wilhelm with you. Matt, there was a really interesting story that came out of Philadelphia over the weekend that a writer there deduced or had some kind of knowledge of the fact that at least on paper right now, the Philadelphia Eagles would be comfortable with Carson Wentz not being active on Sunday afternoons, and that they would have Sam Bradford as their starter.
Chase Daniel as their backup.
Chase Daniel as their backup. I cannot believe that. I can't believe that. I would be shocked if he's not the quarterback when we go there on opening Sunday.
You'd be surprised. It all depends. I mean, if they've now paid both those men in front of Carson Wentz a lot of money. Guaranteed money.
Yeah.
And
but they could move one of them during the preseason.
Absolutely,
right?
They could. Especially
say some team got lost, and I don't like to see anybody get hurt, but invariably it happens.
Or the Jets, who haven't got a deal done with Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Right. Somebody loses a quarterback, and then you call them up and say, hey, listen, how about Chase Daniel? How about Bradford?
That's right. Yeah. The one thing in reading that, you took one perspective. The perspective I thought was, had the Browns
right.
and sat him. We draft him number two the way the Eagles do, where we sat originally. We miss out on Goff, and we take Carson Wentz,
right.
the next best guy,
yep.
and we, behind maybe RG3, Josh McCown, and then have Carson Wentz on the bench. How would that fly here with this fan base?
Jason would be saying, hey, we have a full board of calls right now. Go ahead. And we do right now. Jim is in Cleveland. Hi, Jim. Welcome in to Cleveland Browns Daily.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. That was a good story on Don Rogers. And
boy, what a player.
You know, he's the forgotten Brown. If you talk to the Browns fan base, nobody remembers him.
That's right.
One thing I remember is we were a huge underdog to the Dolphins, and we were beating them like 24-0 in the playoff game. Miner had a big game, but I think Don Rogers had like a broken arm or something. He intercepted the ball in the end zone against Marino, ran it out to the 50-yard line, just made a huge play when they were driving. In that game, and I just would have liked to take my chances with him at safety during the drive. I mean, a lot of people.
There you go.
If we had had him during the drive, I think we could have won that game.
Yeah, and you know, you're not the first person to say that, Jim. The game that Jim is talking about in the playoff game was against Miami, and Mack and Beiner just run through the Dolphin defense down in the Orange Bowl on an incredibly hot and humid day. Okay, in the opening game of the playoffs, and they just dominate. I mean, they have this huge lead at halftime, but they faded in the second half, and the Browns lived on the run. That was the year that Mack and Beiner each had over 1,000 yards.
That's right.
For rushing, and Marino got hot, and the next thing you know, he brought them back and beat them at the buzzer, and they ended up losing that game. It was after that game that Bernie Kosar spoke out in the post-game locker room and said, hey, we got to get with the times here. I think he said, we have to get into the 20th century here and learn that you have to be able to throw the football. Okay, that's when Lindy and Foggy was hired to come in and give the Browns a passing game.
Huh.
Good memory, and he's right. Don Rogers was phenomenal in that game. Just a incredible physical player, and you do. Your mind is left to wander a little bit and wonder what would the Browns defense have been like with Rodgers, you know, during those AFC championship game years against John Elway and the Broncos. Joe is in Tampa Bay. Hi, Joe. Welcome in to Cleveland Browns Daily.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Hey, How are you, Joe?
I'm doing good. I wanted to comment on the most memorable moments.
Go right ahead.
Hey, for me, it was, I would say number one, obviously, now is the Cavaliers. That tops everything. But also, 1997, I was a little kid, and I remember in the 97 World Series, the hit up the middle, I'll never, never forget that. I was crushed as a little kid. I remember afterwards, we went to the airport and met all the players. It was one thing that I'll never get out of my mind. Even after, you know, the Cavaliers won the championship, it's just something that was my first, like, heart-crushing moment. Aside from that, before that, 1995, when the Indians were in the World Series. So,
yeah. Those are good. Those are good ones. You sound like you're in a boat. He is in a boat. Didn't it sound like he was in a boat?
He did sound like he was in a boat.
Yeah, I mean, he's down in Tampa Bay. Charlie Nagy was on the mound by the time that the ball went through, and he, like, flails his glove out to try and knock that thing down, but it gets through, and they end up losing the game. I remember Sandy Alomar just standing at home plate, kind of looking down to make sure that the runner touches home. And then he just walks over to the dugout. It was unbelievable. You talk about champagne. That was, you know, that they had the Indians locker room all ready
prepped,
to go.
Yeah.
All prepped. Chad Ogier's name was being put on the MVP trophy as the MVP of the World Series.
Wow.
He had had an outstanding World Series. Let's go to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And Dan is there. Hi, Dan. Welcome into Cleveland Browns Daily.
Well, thank you. And thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I got three moments, and I got a couple of questions about the Browns, if that's all right, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was born in 51, you know, like Joe DeLamalura said at that conference and said how it was a thrill for him to sit there with Jim Brown. I mean, for me, number one is when they won the 64 championship.
Okay.
And we were underdogs that day.
Heavy underdogs, yeah.
And it's the way to win a championship. Boy, we just pasted them. It was awesome.
Dan, wasn't the game, even though it ends up like 27?
It was close at half.
I think it was scoreless, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very close at the half. And you know, Jim Brown was such a weapon. I mean, he was really in his prime when you look back on it now. And the defense was selling out to stop the run. And then Gary Collins, he just you know, with Warfield on the one side,
yes,
Collins would get deep, and at 6'5", man, he scored three touchdowns. You know, Gary Collins lives here in Hershey, by the way.
I know. He came over a couple of years ago during the alumni weekend one time. He came up into the broadcast booth with Doug and I. It was great
big
to
guy.
Have him in there. Yeah.
He's big. He's like 6'5", that
he
guy.
Is. He
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah.
He
like, when you see him, it's like, wow, that's a big guy. number two, since you took the Jets game, the number two one for me, I mean, the Cavaliers has got to be number two. Let me just say that. I mean,
okay.
That was, oh, my God. So number three, there was the Buffalo game that ended with Clay Matthews making an interception Kelly.
Right.
He was covering Thurman Thomas out of the backfield. And that was a big moment.
Do you remember, Dan, do you remember Ronnie Harmon had a ball go right through his fingertips?
Exactly.
And it was a muddy day. It was a kind of a muddy, you know, early winter day when that game was played. And he had a ball just slide right through his fingertips. And then the next play, I think, was the one that Matthews intercepted the ball.
Yeah, and that was a real hard-hitting game. That's the one where Don Beebe went straight up on his head, if I remember right.
Felix Wright put him up there.
Yeah.
Felix Wright kind of tipped him over. Metcalf had a big kickoff or a punt return in that game. That's the game, Dan, that the Buffalo Bills will tell you that their K-gun offense was given birth because they came out then the next year, and that's when they started their Super Bowl run.
Well, you know, about the Browns, a couple of things. First of all, on RG3, I hear such a disparity on reports about him. Bernie Kosar says he looks phenomenal, and then a lot of people are saying he looks just okay. You know, so I'm curious to know what you guys have seen and what your spin on that evaluation is. And number two, August 1st, where does that fall in the relationship, the training camp? And if Josh Gordon is available, what's your opinion on actually bringing him into the mix and being part of the team?
Well, I'll tell you what. Thanks for the call. Hang up, and we'll give you
– Sure.
Matt's had the best view. Matt, you had more view of RG3.
Yes.
So you have a better overall
look. I do.
All
and
right,
I would
so
say,
what did you think?
If I were to grade RG3 at this point right now on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being, of course, the highest, I'd have RG3 at about a 7.5 right now. Okay? But – he's trending higher by taking on and spending more time with Hugh Jackson in this offense.
Okay.
And we'll say he started as a 6. This is a guy that sat out, you know, a year of football, you know, on another football team that ended up going to the playoffs and got beat out by Kirk Cousins. So, and he's relearning what it takes to play quarterback, especially play quarterback in this Hugh Jackson system. I would say by the end of training camp, we can win football games with RG3, and I would say he goes from good to getting better, not great, to like that 8, 8.5 by the end of training camp. But there are just little things that I see having practiced against Aaron Rodgers or watched him in practice and Phillip Rivers and Drew Brees. And one of those things, as I say, for those who come out and watch practice, the ball shouldn't hit the ground. If you are truly in sync, and I know we have young players at wide receiver, we have a quarterback now playing wide receiver, and so there's a learning and growth process there, but when you really got it going and you're slinging it and those guys are doing their job on the other end, the ball shouldn't hit the ground regardless of how great our defense is playing, and that is something that I keep in the back of my head as I watch RG3. There's slight indecision. He can make a great play, and it's not that he makes a bonehead play, but then it's just a blah play. And I think the great quarterbacks are the ones that mow through, get the ball to the check down, throw the ball over the fence into the neighbor's yard, and make those decisions on a consistent basis.
Having said that, as camp unfolds and when they finally start playing those games, when they go to Green Bay and then, you know, they come home and they go to Tampa and then they end with the Bears. Okay, well now, how much does he need to play in those games? This is the trickiest thing for coaches, is how much do you play these guys in these preseason games, and how do you align them the right way? In other words, if you're going to go with him and he's your guy, then you want to have your best offensive line in there when he's playing, but then do you put too much pressure on that offensive line of a guy like Joe Thomas suddenly playing deep into preseason games? But if he's going to be the guy, and if he still has to go from a 7.5 up to an 8.5, close to a 9, before you're comfortable to put him out there against the Eagles on opening Sunday, how much does he have to play?
I think he has to play a lot. And I think if you've listened to Hugh Jackson, to get better at playing the game of football, you have to play the game of football. You know, at the speed, you will play it when the bullets are flying. And the preseason is our only true opportunity, because even though he's going to say we're going to let it go in practice, it's never going to be like it is in a game. It's going to be darn close, but it's not in that setting that you can truly evaluate how this guy will play. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the prototypical, what, two series and out in
it's
that
like,
first preseason game.
Yeah, like 12 plays.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's 15 or 18, you know, and then just, I'd say, one series more in every one of those football games for a guy like RG3 than you would prototypically think.
All right, because remember now, McCown knows the drill. You know, if you're going to keep him around, all right, McCown knows the drill. He knows how to get ready, and he knows how much he needs to play or how little he needs to play.
Right.
The other thing is Kessler. I mean, what are you going to do with him, and how much do you play him, and how much of an investment are you going to make in him this year?
Sure. Yeah. Well, here's and again, I know we got to grab a break, but think about it like this for those who are either optimistic or pessimistic. The Eagles are, to me, on paper, the bottom dweller of their division, in the same boat that you could look at the Browns in the AFC North.
Absolutely.
They use their second pick in the overall draft on a guy that's going to not be in uniform. We took a guy and we reached for him in the, what, third round to take Cody Kessler, who might be our guy, not in uniform. Okay? Mm-hmm. So both of those guys are going to sit back and learn. Okay, we took ours in the third round, we have their first next year.
Which is the old-fashioned
way. Which is the old-fashioned
way. That was the way it
Correct.
Used to be done.
All it
right.
is.
We're going to grab a break. That was great. Tremendous. And we want you to keep on calling in. Give us your memories. Love going down memory lane with you, because you pique my memory of these moments in these games that were just unbelievable. That Bills playoff game was an incredible game. Back and forth shootout between Jim Kelly and the Browns going after him. And that was a great, great game. So thanks to Dan and Hershey PA for doing that. We'll take a timeout. We're coming back with more here on Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Now back to Cleveland Browns Daily with Jim Donovan and Matt Wilhelm on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Hey, I want to clear up one question. Dan in Hershey, PA asked a second question. He asked about RG3, and Matt elaborated on that. Now, the Josh Gordon part, August 1 is when he can reapply again, and we go through the whole process of whether or not he's okay to come back in. The NFL will make a decision. If they go thumbs up and he's back in, then the Browns will have a decision.
Correct. And that's exactly where I was going to pick up if we, you know, when you brought that up, is just because he's back in the NFL, you know, doesn't necessarily mean he has to have, yes, we have his rights and that Browns logo is next to his name, but is he going to be received by the Cleveland Browns? And I think it's going to weigh on Sashi Brown and Hugh Jackson. I'm sure just the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure
and management and ownership
absolutely, because you're a representation of the owners. It's going to be something that on paper you go, "Oh wow, give me him."
Absolutely.
But then when you get him in the building, you really want to have him around. Maybe there's a weekend that he'll be there to meet with the three and maybe spend time with them in the building, out of the building, for you to understand how truly rehabilitated is this young man.
Now, that's only if the NFL says he's okay to come back in.
Correct.
Todd in Avon Lake. Hi, Todd. Welcome in to Cleveland Browns Daily.
Hey, great show. Good to hear you on there, Jim.
Oh, thanks.
I guess some of my favorite moments, of course, was the double overtime against the New York Jets.
Great.
And I think also one of those Houston games there where Matthews ended up intercepting it and throwing back that lateral backwards, but they ended up winning that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Say Matthews not in the Hall of Fame. I mean, that's a great topic for conversation there as well. And then I also think that it was really classy how the Browns had Beiner and Jim Brown in there as well. And it was great. Another key moment was when the Indians beat the Mariners to go into the
World Series.
Because that was the first time in my lifetime where it was like, wow, we finally made it.
I know. Yep. They beat Randy Johnson that night.
Yeah. And the whole Don Rogers thing, that was incredible. I one time had an opportunity to ask Canford Dixon about that. And he said the last thing that he remembers that night was he was just leaving that night with a couple guests, and that was the last time he saw him. And he certainly said, had he been there, things probably would have been a lot different in Brown's history.
So. Oh, I know. Yeah. Sad story. Thank you, Todd. That is,
yeah.
I'm glad that so many people remember Don Rogers, and that great story really kind of piques your memory about that. John is in Appleton, Wisconsin, where we normally stay when the Browns go out to play Green Bay. We always stay in Appleton.
Hello, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. And I know you guys are coming here again for preseason football this year, so can't wait for that event.
Yes.
Just a couple quick thoughts, Jim. Longtime Brown fan stuck in Packers country, so it's not easy living here, but that's my choice. You know, you had almost taken the words right out of my mouth on one comment about the Don Rogers situation. I never thought that Coach Schottenheimer ever got the credit to pull that team together
right,
to go 12-4 when you lost a tragic situation with Don like that. And like other callers have already said, how good could we have been with an all-pro safety with Panther Frank and everything else? And then just a couple quick things here on three memorable Browns games for me.
Go.
These maybe aren't the most greatest Browns games, but just three games that I always will remember as a fan. Obviously, the 86 divisional playoff win over the Jets is one of them, you know, coming back from the dead. Another one that I'll always remember, Jim, in the snow, week 16 in 1988, when Don Strock brought us back from three touchdowns down against Gary Glanville.
And remember, they wrote the song, Strock Around the Clock.
Yep.
The next day.
I remember Don Strock hitting Webster Slaughter on a post to win the game into the dog pound. And,
right. That was a great game.
And then the other one I remember, the caller before just mentioned this, but I think it was either the night before Christmas or two nights before Christmas, Saturday night, week 16, 1989, we had a big lead in the House of Pain. Oilers came back, Clay Matthews with the fumble. Warren Moon hit, I think, Drew Hill for a touchdown on the next play. And then Bernie took us about 90 yards
yes.
in about 2 minutes. And then Kevin Mack came back and sealed the division title for us. And they maybe aren't famous games in the history of the Browns, but those are just three memorable
yeah.
games as a fan that I'll never forget.
So
thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thanks
Thank
for calling.
You.
Yeah, we'll see you in Appleton. The Don Strock, they used to write the songs, the Bernie, okay,
yes.
and then Strock Around the Clock. Now, the Browns beat Houston that day with an amazing comeback. And had to play Houston like 6 days later, again in Cleveland, on Christmas Eve, and they lost in the playoff that
Man.
Day. I think Strock broke his thumb early in the playoff game, and I think Mike Pagel had to come in and play in that game. That's the year the Browns lost quarterbacks like every week. Thus, that's why Strock was here. Let's squeeze in John in North Carolina. Hi, John.
Jim, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to have you on.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, congratulations on your sports award earlier this year.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Hey, a couple quick things. First of all, how good does it feel to be a world champion in Cleveland again?
Great.
I'm almost 40, and I've never got to experience it, so it's wonderful.
It's great.
Yeah, so two Browns games, man, that really stick in my mind, probably just because I was young and got to watch it, but Bernie Kosar to Webster Slaughter on a Monday night game versus the Bears backed up against the end zone.
Right. Yes, yes.
That was such a wonderful game. It was one of the first Monday night games I was allowed to stay up and watch.
The Bears were still, you know, really good defensively
yes.
at that time.
Yeah, I believe they were beating us up to that point
right.
as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like a come-from-behind win. I love that game. The next one would be, of course, Eric Metcalf returning two to the house against Pittsburgh.
That was at a time when Bill Cowher was really new as the head coach of the Steelers. And, of course, it's changed dramatically. He couldn't beat the Browns then.
Right.
The Browns always knocked him off at that point. And it looked like, if you remember, John, it looked like they were gonna get out of here with a win that day. And Metcalf hit those two returns. Unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah. Still one of my favorite players all time. I still have his jersey that I like to break out on the rare occasion.
Well, John, thanks very much for calling in. John in North Carolina.
All right.
Yeah, that was – yeah. We'll take a break, and we'll come back and wrap this show up as we continue on this Monday edition of Cleveland Browns Daily. Matt and I will put a bow on this show right after this.
Now back to Cleveland Browns Daily with Jim Donovan and Matt Wilhelm on ESPN 850 WKNR.
And you could add to that list Sam in Akron. Let's go to Sam in Akron on the telephone. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mr. Donovan, how you doing today?
I couldn't be better.
Hey, I just want to let you know real quick, in my household, you're known as the voice. Every time we hear your voice, we know there's a big game around the corner, and I want to thank you for all your years of service.
Well, thank you.
And I'm going to switch the rules up here real quick, if you don't mind.
Go.
My number two is definitely Cleveland with the championship. Unbelievable. Number three, the Cleveland Indians when they knocked the Yankees off in the playoffs.
Oh,
that was a memorable experience.
Right.
And any true Cleveland fan has to extend the Cleveland territory to Columbus. And Mr. Wilhelm, when you laid the wood on Dorsey to win that title, that's
Thank you very much. Oh, boy.
It was my pleasure.
Sam, thanks very much. I was just going to say that. I mean, your personal memory has to be that game.
It is.
I want to tell you, I was outside Heinz Field when that happened. The Browns were in the playoffs, okay, and we were over doing the 11 o'clock news, and I don't know why we were doing it because nobody was watching us. Everybody was watching Ohio State. And we're in this little live truck to get the signal back, and we're looking at the game on like a 12-inch little monitor.
Yep.
And we were going crazy. That was a great, great moment.
It really was. And honestly, you know, living in this great state, you know, after a championship like that, it makes me seem like – everyone I meet was at that game.
Absolutely.
Everybody that comes up to me that recognizes me, they're like, hey, I was at the 2002 National Championship game. I'm like, you too?
Yeah.
It seems like everybody was, which is awesome. That's a representation of our state.
If Trump and Clinton could get those kind of votes, those kind of numbers, they would be on the way.
That's right.
Matt had a ball. Always have a ball. Have a great rest of your week. Have a great vacation time.
I will. Thank you.
Jason Gibbs produced the show today. Thanks very, very much. A great, great article again from Jerry Bembry, senior writer, ESPN, theundefeated.com, on the 30th anniversary of us losing a great player, Don Rogers, to an overdose on the night before he was married. I urge you to read it. It was a great, great read on a very sad story. Anyway, we'll end on a positive note. Thank you very, very much for joining us. You were great today. And you've been listening to Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR.
You've been listening to Cleveland Browns Daily, a production of the Cleveland Browns and ESPN 850 WKNR.